enough attention has, I think, been paid to their needs and their grievances, if you like, and they too have been drawn to the far right. And so this combination, it is a predominantly male vote, but not only a male vote. Increasing number of women also, surprisingly, are voting for the far right, just as a surprising number of women in my eyes voted for Trump, despite his background and his relationships with women and the way he's been found to have treated women. So there you go.
It is absolutely amazing. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about the threats to democracy that are very real on the other side of the Atlantic. Our guest today is Paul Taylor, who is in Paris. He's a senior visiting fellow with the European Policy Center, and he's written a piece in The Guardian called Trump has declared civilizational war on Europe. It won't be easy, but here's how to fight back. And we will get to fighting back, that's for sure. But there's a lot of similarities. I mean, young men here also feel like, hey, they had a right to a job, a right to be able to afford a car and a big truck. And now they can't afford these things anymore, that there is a real affordability crisis, which Trump calls a hoax. But one thing that is different, unlike the U.S., in Europe, there has been an expectation that there would indeed be affordable housing, universal quality education, health care, and security of employment. Is that also playing into the right somehow, the fact that these things are slipping away?
Yeah, the fact is that our social democracies, which were built mostly after World War II, and introduced different forms, depending on our different European countries, of public health care, either free at the point of delivery or else reimbursed by a health insurance fund and so on, but all done by the public sector. Quality education, more and more people able to graduate from high school and go to university, and the more people able to do a second university degree and so on. These are all accomplishments of the post-World War II social democracy. And that when I say social democracy, I don't mean just the policy of social democrats in government, but this was something that was shared between conservative and Labour governments in the UK, between Gaullist and socialist governments in France. Uh-huh. There were uh-huh. degrees of difference about this, but basically the construction of the modern European welfare state was a bipartisan affair, and it remains a bipartisan. And you know, even the extreme right in most European countries is not talking about dismantling this. Unlike the United States, where Trump has just wiped out free healthcare for millions of Americans in his great big budget. In Europe, even the far right is saying no. You know, we want to keep the welfare system. In fact, we actually want people to be able to retire earlier. But essentially, we want to stop spending the money on immigrants. And if we only stop spending welfare money on the on immigrants and on illegal immigrants in particular, then somehow the books would be balanced. Now, that sadly is a myth. Yeah. You know, when you look at the numbers of money that actually goes to migrants, and there's lots of good research that shows that migrants actually pay more into our welfare systems than
same
they
as
get
here.
Out.
Yep,
and that they are the people that we actually need, not only to fill the jobs in our society, which foreign people don't want to do, or for which there are simply no candidates, they are also the people that we need to take care of our elderly and an aging society.
Yes.
Our birth rates are really low in Europe, lower than in the United States. We need their employment. We need their contributions. They are the people who are going to pay our pensions.
Yes, but they're a different color.
And yet, they're a different color. Some of them are a different religion. And our aging societies are increasingly uncomfortable with them. And too often, our demagogues on the far right have success, amplified by a growing right-wing media ecosystem, by conflating brown faces, immigrants with crime, violence, and the tiny fringe of Islamic extremism. And the left tends to err on the side of kind of ignoring the fact that there is a problem, a genuine problem of radical Islamism, and attempts to dragoon the Muslim parts of our society into radical Islamist ideology and practice, and ultimately into violence and hostility to our societies. But that's not the main problem we face, and it doesn't reflect the reality of the overwhelming number of immigrants, including Muslim immigrants, whether it be in France, the UK, Germany, or elsewhere. So, the fact is that this is being turned into a divisive issue for political gain by our extreme right, as it has been in the United States. Now, question. In the old days, the United States was on the side of the Democrats and the liberals in Europe, who welcomed immigration. After all, the United States is a nation of immigrants, and who fought for democracy, for media freedom, for pluralism, and against intolerance, prejudice, and extremism. Now, for the first time in our history, we have the United States saying that it will, quotes, foster resistance to the dominant liberal ideology in Europe, and foster resistance also to European integration, and specifically to the European Union, which it sees as some kind of hellish beast because it believes in sharing sovereignty. And it believes in pooling sovereignty and in supranational governance, which is kind of the devil incarnate for these ideologues in the White House. We are facing an unknown society, unknown situation, and you can see how it's and it's amplified by what some people are calling techno-fascism.
Yes, I was going to ask about that.
Extraordinary power and influence of social media, driven by people in the United States who believe that their power should be completely unregulated, preferably untaxed as well.
Yeah.
For the first time in the history, the United States is on the other side, and we're starting to see an impact. And then, you're going to ask me, so what's happened in the last 12 months? How has this changed things?
What has happened in the last 12 months? What has changed things away from this nice, stable situation where there was real democracy, a social democracy, and people could relate to and depend on their being connected to their governments as part of Europe?
Well, to be honest, it goes back further than 12 months. But if you just look at the last 12 months, we had a situation in Romania where the integrity of the presidential election had been so undermined by the abuses of social media, TikTok in particular, but also other social media, where chatbot accounts had pushed an unknown candidate who claimed to have no election spending whatever, but somebody, and it turned out it was at least in part the Russian Secret Service, was paying millions to carpet bomb Romania with social media advertising for this unknown candidate who came from nowhere to go to first place on the first round. And the Constitutional Court in Romania, after due deliberation, decided that the integrity of the election had been so undermined by this external interference using social media and so on that it annulled the first round of the election. It barred that candidate from standing again because it said that he had clearly made fraudulent declarations about not spending any money on campaigning when all this campaigning was out there for him. But this caused great controversy. Obviously, that controversy was added to by the fact that U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance then came to Europe and said that the threat facing Europe was not from Russia and China, but from undermining European values by suppressing freedom of speech. And he gave this as an example, the fact that this rigged attempt to railroad an unknown candidate into the presidency of Romania, an unknown candidate who happened to be Russia-friendly, and mm-hmm. happened to be supported by secretly by Russian chatbots and so on, that was undermining freedom of speech. And, you know, what freedom of speech was he talking about? He was talking about freedom of hate speech. Yes. He was talking about, freedom, anonymous freedom to libel, to defame, you know. Now, the United States president slaps great big lawsuits on media. He claims they're defaming him. But the Europeans, they're not supposed to have any kind of legislation which restricts what you can say on the internet or whatever. I mean, this is incredible. And it is talking the book of people like Elon Musk, who bankrolled Trump's presidential campaign and who continue to be financial supporters of the president and with whom he does business, notably in the cryptocurrency area. So here we have a conflation of tech interests, cryptocurrency interests, and the power of the White House in a situation where it's not up to me to make judgments about the United States, but the question of where conflicts of interest arise, where the business interests of the royal family in the United States end and the policy of the United States begins. So in Europe, apart from the integrity of elections being undermined, we had, for example, Elon Musk turning over his X platform to the extreme right German party Alternative for Germany, which has been described by the country's own domestic intelligence service as being an extreme right organization, doing a friendly softball interview with the leader of that party and doing everything he could to encourage Germans from outside, from Silicon Valley, to vote fascist. You know, what's going on here? The world turned upside down. Now, that I also say that the influence partly coming from the United States is harming the ability of governments to implement evidence-based policies on things such as climate change and vaccination. When you have the President of the United States saying that all the science showing the, as well as the evidence of our own eyes, showing the damage of climate change is a hoax, so on. How do European governments resist this kind of pressure to deregulate, to get rid of climate rules? And so now you're seeing very strong pressure on the European authorities to roll back decisions like, for example, the phasing out of the internal combustion engine for cars, the move to electric vehicles.
Right.
And likewise on vaccination. When you have an anti-vaxxer who is the U.S. Secretary of Health, and the influence that has, the knock-on effect that has. And, we see this in the weakening. There's a parallel between the assault on the courts going on in some parts of the United States and on justices who rule that Trump's actions are illegal, and the weakening of watchdogs, courts, and the role of the European courts also in countries such as Hungary, Poland under the previous government, now Slovakia, where they're adopting declarations that their national constitution is above European law, which means the agreed European treaty law would no longer apply in their countries, things like this, or simply where they pack the courts with cronies in defiance of the independence of the judiciary. And then dismantle anti-corruption police as they've done in Slovakia, digital regulators, and we find ourselves in a situation where our liberal democracy, it's not crumbling everywhere, but it is under assault in a lot of places. There are also assaults on public broadcasters, on whom the public has depended for so many decades.
Yes.
There used to be a time, you remember Pat Buchanan in the United States.
Of course.
He said you're entitled to your own opinion, but not to your own facts.
Right.
Well, nowadays, they're behaving as if everybody's entitled to their own facts.
Yes.
There is no such thing as an objective fact. And therefore, what you believe is what matters, not what's true.
Absolutely. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today in Paris is Paul Taylor, Senior Visiting Fellow at the European Policy Center, who's written a piece titled, Trump Has Declared Civilizational War on Europe. It won't be easy, but here's how to fight back. And it is having very effective opinions over facts. And we were talking just now about techno-fascism on the rise and being used very effectively by the right. At the European Policy Center conference recently, many argued for speeding up the EU's existing digital laws. Please explain and tell us the significance of this issue.
Well, in the European Union, we have adopted a series of laws that regulate e-commerce, online platforms, very large online platforms, and so on. And essentially, we say it's the same thing. You can't say something online that you wouldn't be allowed to say in a newspaper, for example. These are regulations against racial incitement, against incitement to violence, to murder. There are a range of things, and where the responsibility is put on the platform operators, that they have to moderate the content on their platforms, and they are responsible for making sure that incitement to murder, all of these things are erased as rapidly as possible when people post them. And there are a variety of ways that those companies had begun to cooperate, had a fact-checking department, moderation departments. I think of companies such as Meta, which owns Facebook, Twitter, which became X.
Yes.
And a lot of those departments were either closed down or radically downsized after and around the time Trump won the election and came to power, because the tech bros found that it was costing them money to do this. They didn't want to do it. And so the European Union has started investigating these companies, Apple, Meta, Google, TikTok, accusing them of breaching EU tech rules over issues such as denying researchers access to the platform data, so as to check how their algorithms work and see whether their algorithms in fact are neutral or whether they encourage radical extreme content. The ability to notify illegal content and challenge moderation decisions that are made by those organizations, all these things which exist in European law, and these companies increasingly are saying, to hell with your law. The only thing that counts for us is the law of the United States. We are the law. And so the most recent action of the European Commission,
yes,
was to slap a 120 million euro fine on X, owned by Elon Musk, formerly known as Twitter, for making users pay for the blue tick authentication when it turned out they weren't actually doing any effective verification of who the users were. So the European Union concluded that this was a scam. European regulators concluded that this was a scam to make people pay to use X for a blue tick that was effectively worthless. Now, Mr. Musk didn't like that, so what did he do?
Yeah.
He barred the European Union, European Commission, from doing any advertising on his platform. Are these platforms neutral? No, they are the plaything of billionaires. And The problem is that technology, especially with the advances of AI, is just moving forward much faster than EU regulation. When you ask that, as I did, one of the European Union top regulation writers about this, a woman called Renata Nicolai, who wrote some of these draft laws, I said, well, why is enforcement taking so long? Well, she said, because of the rule of law. We are a law-based community, and this is a due process system. And that means that, first of all, we have to get our facts together, and then people have a right to receive our complaints and to respond to them, and they can make concessions and adjustments to close the case, or else we have to take them to court. And if we issue a fine, then they can appeal against the fine and so on.
Sure.
So they can draw out the process. I saw this 20 years ago with the way Microsoft drew out the antitrust cases against it in the European Union. And you can drag them out so long that
sure.
the original technology involved is almost obsolete by the time the judgments become final. That's what we're up against. But I think that the European Union at least is trying to regulate this. And of course, the question is, are they fighting with one hand tied behind their back?
Uh-huh.
Are European governments leaning on the European Commission to say, hey, go soft on the fines on the tech giants, because we don't want to have another battle with Trump. You know, we're already battling him on trade. We're desperately trying to keep the United States engaged in European security. Had to make concessions to him. And the last thing we need is for you to fine one of these big Silicon Valley giants a lot of money, and for him then to come at us again with more tariffs, or saying, well, in that case, I'll withdraw my troops, or I'll throw you to the Russian wolves.
And Musk, as well as Trump, seem to have unlimited money. So in terms of lawsuits, they can drag it out and fight as long as they feel like it and take away the power of the lawsuit. Go ahead.
Big money buys expensive lawyers, indeed.
And sure.
there are lots of ways of dragging these processes out. But I think, the question is, we're going to have to live with social media. We're going to have to uphold our liberal democracy in the age of social media. How do we do this, and how do we fight back? And that's what we were trying to discuss at this conference. And there are a range, if you like, of suggestions, and they're not mutually exclusive. One is simply be bold, enforce our laws. Don't chicken out. Let Trump be the one that chickens out. Enforce our laws, bring technology, bring big tech to heel. That's number one. Number two, and I think especially for people on the left, is we've got to really get better at addressing the affordability crisis.
Right.
The key is, in that argument, the key is to address people's bread and butter needs for affordable housing, well-paid jobs, and effective public services.
Yes.
The main reason for the rise of the extreme right and the radical left in that telling is that, and the reason why they attract particularly younger people and older industrial workers, as I said, is the failure of the mainstream center-left and center-right parties that have governed for decades to deliver on those issues. So, that's where we have to get better. The trouble with that is that the solutions to the housing crisis usually reside at national or local level, not under an EU roof. And they're hard to deliver quickly because of planning
yes.
regulations, what you call NIMBYism, not in my backyard,
right.
Because of the high cost of building public housing and so on. So there are things that different social democratic governments have tried, making it easier for first-time buyers, first-time borrowers, tax breaks and stuff like that. But these are all benefits that can be open to abuse, and we're working in a time when European governments don't have a lot of money in the coffers.
Uh-huh.
Many European social democrats and leftists are actually excited about the New York mayoral election victory of Zoran
sure.
Mandani.
Yes.
Because his platform was laser-focused on a few issues: free bus travel, rent control, public nonprofit grocery stores in poor neighborhoods, free child care, building more affordable housing. Well, some of those things we have in Europe. There are European cities that already have free bus travel, or we have free bus travel for the elderly, for example, and so on. Rent control, well, some European cities have that, and some are now also trying to control private rentals, short-term holiday rentals for platforms such as Airbnb, which are reducing the available housing stock for people in cities and therefore increasing the rents for working people who can ill afford it because rich tourists are coming in and paying the landlords more than the landlords would earn if they were renting to ordinary working people or retired people or whatever. Non-profit grocery stores in poor neighborhoods, that's sort of less of, I think, of an issue in Europe than it is in the United States, but free childcare. Yes. Many European countries already have free childcare.
Wow.
And others that don't are looking at it. One of the big reasons for that is because it helps increase the number of women in the workforce. And the higher sure. the proportion of women in the workforce is, the more you have people paying into pensions and social insurance systems, and therefore the better those systems are in balance and the less they are in deficit, which is the problem that we have at the moment. Against that, some on the far right, on the radical right, again, this is coming in more from the United States than being traditionally European, are raising, you know, the value of the trad wife, the stay-at-home mom, argue that women will have more babies if they stay at home and get benefits to stay at home. Now, that's once again, this is not an evidence-based policy. And they've been trying to do this in Viktor Orban's far-right government in Hungary has been trying to up the birth rate with all sorts of stay-at-home mom benefits, and you know has barely a glitch in the birth rate to show.
Oh, interesting.
For it. So it's a policy which may be well intended, but is just not effective and costs a lot of money. And there are countries in Europe, in Spain, for example, the left-wing government
yes.
has managed to raise social benefits and welcome immigrants. They have that has increased the population. So in the last 20 years, I've seen the population of Spain and the population of Poland were roughly the same. Spain's 40 million. Spain is now about 48 million because it's welcomed a lot of immigrants. Poland is about 38 million because its birth rate has sagged, and young Poles have emigrated to find higher paying jobs in Western Europe. And so Spain is the one that's presiding now over the fastest growing economy in Europe. And when you have a fast growing economy, you have money coming into the welfare system and you can afford it. So that's a model that a lot of European social democrats are looking at. On the other hand, has been said, it hasn't stopped the growth of far-right populism in Spain either. Spain's anti-migrant
sure.
Vox Party
right.
has seen its support jump from, 12% at the last general election in 2023 to almost 20% today. And, wherever you look, it has to be said, social democratic parties are losing ground across much of Europe. Even where they're in government, such as the UK, they are losing ground in public opinion polls, and they are living in fear of the far right.
As are we. I'm Bert Cohen. You're listening to Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Paul Taylor, who is with the European Policy Center, who's in Paris, who's written a piece in the Guardian, a popular European progressive news outlet. The title of the piece is "Trump has declared civilizational war on Europe. It won't be easy, but here's how to fight back." And in terms of fighting back, my old friend Abby Hoffman used to say that the relationship between the left and the right is perfect. The left is masochistic. The right is sadistic. We have a tradition here in the U.S. that that the Democratic Party divides. Here, there's a growing divide between the middle of the road, so-called centrists in the Democratic Party, and the more traditional Franklin Roosevelt-type progressives. Is there a center-left there, and is it going through similar growing pains? Is it tearing itself apart? Is there division on the social left, the traditional left?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, in Europe, in many cases, what you've seen is the rise of parties to the left of the traditional center-left social democrats. So in France, currently the largest party on the left is a thing called La France Insoumise, sort of unsubmissive France, if you like, a literal translation, of a left-wing firebrand called Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who kind of are Bernie Sanders. The question in all of these countries, there's the same in Spain, where you have a party called CUMAR, which is to the left of the Spanish Socialist Party.
No.
In Germany, you have Die Linke, and you also had a Sarah Wagenknecht party that were both to the left of the Social Democrats. And obviously, they accuse these people of being social traitors. We've heard it before, just as the communists accused the Social Democrats in Germany during the rise of the Nazis of being social traitors. And they've concentrated their energy on fighting against the center-left instead of fighting against the real enemy. This is one of the things that we live with. Now, you could say that in countries where you have proportional representation, electoral systems, that two fishing boats catch more fish. And provided those two parties can then join up and govern together, which has happened in Spain, it's better to have several parties trying to attract the different elements of the left-wing vote. And it's true that the social democratic parties of Europe have grown comfortable. They've become middle-class parties. They've become parties of people with a not only a high school but a university education. They are parties, I guess, that reflect us rather than our working-class parents. And they have been successful in government over a long period, but that has now created a backlash, because when somebody like Tony Blair was in government in Britain, he was part of the sort of soft touch deregulation of the economy that led partly to the financial crisis of 2008. And so that's why one of the reasons why the Social Democrats in Europe are having a hard time. The Congress question is the radical left capable of winning elections? And the answer may be yes in New York City, but is it in Alabama, or even in Ohio, or in the other swing states of the United States? Because our electoral systems are such that you've got to win elections in the center ground, basically, and by better mobilizing those groups of voters who don't always go out and vote. So, and that leads me to a very interesting argument, which was made by a woman called Lisa Witter, who actually happens to be American, and is CEO of the Better Politics Foundation, which is based in Europe. And she basically says the left has got to needs to get back to doing grassroots politics better. It's partly that the extremists have taken a leaf out of our traditional book. They have become better campaigners than we are. We're kind of lazy. We rely on ad agencies and political consultants and all these and pollsters and so on. And the extremists, partly because they were sort of shut out of the mainstream media for a long time, not that they are now. They're rampant in it, but during their period, if you like, of internal exile, they got very savvy at using social media, at using influencers, at finding clever ways of mobilizing people. So Viktor Orban's Fidesz party in Hungary makes huge and effective use of paid online influencers. How that fits with the party campaign funding rules, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
In Romania, the hard right, our party, the Alliance for the Union of Romanians, has got a very clever, playful app which attracts and rewards young activists for going out and doing stuff, and you can win prizes for on the app for things that you do, and that makes them more assiduous at the shoe leather politics of leafleting marketplaces,
right,
of doorstep campaigning. So the idea that you don't need to campaign anymore because it's all a, it's now a social media election or a TV election, which is very much something that has taken over the mainstream, some of the mainstream parties. You know, we need to go back and revisit that and look at how you can use grassroots activism and how you can use the social media techniques as well to win positive pro-European social democratic message. All is not lost. It doesn't guarantee success for centrism, but it at least it gets us in the fight with a bit more heart as well.
So it's a combination of using the social media better than the center-left has before, as well as good old-fashioned shoe leather.
And addressing people's real needs and concerns, because, you know, the left has not, you know, done well enough in government for ordinary working people and their families.
Right.
And, you know, and then we have to a degree, we have to raise the alarm about the threat that these parties pose to our way of life. It's true that it didn't help Kamala Harris, for example, to have made her campaign so much into a democracy versus autocracy campaign, even though she was right.
She was right.
She was accurate in warning that America would otherwise face authoritarianism, and that's what we're starting to see. And how far it will go depends on how resistant the checks and balances inherent in the American current constitution, and how the swing of the political pendulum in the United States elections turns out to be. We don't know that, but it's not looking particularly encouraging at the moment.
Well, here in the U.S., first it was Hillary Clinton, then Kamala Harris ran on platforms that were not clearly for anything. They were just anti-Trump. We on the center-left are much better at describing and analyzing a problem rather than, as you say, crafting effective strategy to combat the forces undermining democracy. So what? Tell us about the role of the European Policy Center that you're involved in, which met in Brussels recently. And how effective do you think the EPC may be in fighting back? Because we're interested in fighting back.
Well, we're doing our bit. We're trying to be a convener for those people who are really concerned about the threats to liberal democracy in Europe. We're offering ideas of our own in terms of policies, in terms also of how to, you know, frame the debate about authoritarianism and illiberal tendencies in Europe. We are encouraging the European Union to enforce its own laws. After all, we made those laws. They were voted through by democratically by our governments and by our European Parliament, we have to enforce those and take the fight, frankly, to the tech bros if they want to claim that technology should be more powerful than the rule of law and that technology should not be regulated. Trump sees this as some kind of European tax on American companies. And it's true that many of these companies, not just American ones, but for example, TikTok, are not European companies. But that's, you know, we're not fighting them because they're foreign. We're fighting them because they are doing things that undermine the rule of law and liberal democracy in our societies. And, you know, maybe they do in yours too.
Well, in the Second World War, Europe was first to fight against fascism. It took a little while for the U.S. to follow their lead. Perhaps that's happening now. How can, if people are interested in perhaps getting in touch with what the European Policy Center has to offer, what can you suggest? Is there a way to look at that online?
It's very simple. www.epc.eu.
Uh-huh.
And you'll find our writings there. You'll find videos of our conferences, including the annual conference we've just been talking about, And I think you'll find lots of stimulating information and debate about the state of politics and society in Europe today.
So perhaps the U.S. can learn and start fighting back as the European Policy Center has started doing. Well, thank you so much.
We can learn from each other.
Yes.
Can learn from each other.
What's your degree of optimism? Final question.
Well, I'm a natural optimist because I had a happy childhood.
Ah.
But I've never seen the world in my lifetime in as dire a state as I think is today. I always thought of myself as a member of the happy, lucky post-war generation. Now, yes. I'm not so sure that we are post-war.
No. Thank you so much for being with us, Paul Taylor. Thank you.
All the best, Bert.
Thank you. If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.
To town with his wagon broken down. The farmer is.
Tune into the Dirt Bag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and